Welcome to Battery Generation, your electromobility podcast for European battery research. We have a great guest for this show. It is Dr. Billy Wu. Hello.
Hi, and thanks for having me back.
Billy, you are a reader, associate professor, and director of research in the Dyson School of Design Engineering at the Imperial College London.
Billy, as battery expert, you're frequently being asked to do technical due diligence for investors assessing the feasibility of battery technologies, sometimes even very exotic battery tech. First of all, why don't you tell us about your personal experiences when it comes to battery funding battery ventures?
I think we're at a really exciting time where we're going to see so many different things from not just cars, but planes, trains, and all sorts of other things being electrified. And I do think that there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all solution, that we are likely going to be developing technologies specific for those where you might have extremely high temperature, extremely low temperature operations, and other extreme conditions as well. And that kind of motivates this need for increasing the portfolio of technologies that we have right now. I often get involved with helping venture capitalists and others to kind of assess which technologies have the most promise, which are likely to form feasible businesses in the future. And often the two communities speak very different languages. In academia, we like to go into the deep mechanistic understandings of how different battery technologies work. But we also need to interweave that with the economics of how is this going to scale? What are some of the challenges? Will this actually make money in terms of profit margins and these other metrics that as scientists we don't traditionally look at as much?
What is your specific role in these projects? I assume we're not talking only stationary batteries, we're talking about very new exotic battery cell chemistries for new electromobility battery cells or something?
I've gotten involved with various technical due diligence activities across the spectrum of battery technologies, from solid state batteries, lithium sulfur batteries, flow batteries, and so on. So it's really exciting to see what people are developing. My involvement typically is on the technical side, where a venture fund comes and approaches me, says that they're working with some exciting researchers who've got this really interesting technology. Inevitably, everyone says they've got the holy grail of battery technologies. And I suppose my role is to kind of come in, understand the technology a little bit better, explain some of the challenges with that, really understand where they're at and what sort of resources are they likely to need in the future. Alongside the core intellectual property, I often get involved with reviewing some of the patents, the data that they present. And it's a bit of a wild west, if I'm being honest, in terms of how people present the data and what they say, because the number of times I've heard double the energy density, half the price, it needs substantiating, and it's easier said than done often. I think there certainly are innovations to be made, but equally, I do think sometimes there is an overstatement of some of the battery technologies out there. In fact, there was a recent Nature nanotech paper which came out under the title of Small Batteries, Big Claims, and I think that is quite true.
Thank you, Billy, for mentioning that, because we have also been thinking, we have been reading so many headlines that claim to revolutionize the battery field, and then for years nothing happened. What's the holdup? Did they oversell the promise? Did they never have a really good solution? Or was it just too hard?
I think the reality is a combination of things. So to raise funding, often you have to sell an exciting vision of what your battery can do. And again, there's an article out there which kind of proposes this idea of my battery is better than yours, where when you read a lot of research papers, you often say, and our battery is better than everyone else's out there. In reality, for a practical battery, not only do you need the fundamentals to be sound, you also need the practicality to be there. So I think it's a combination that when people start to raise money in these areas, naturally, they have to somewhat oversell themselves in terms of saying how great the technology is. Naturally, you don't hear about some of the drawbacks which often come with the scale-up. So history has taught us that from conceptual discovery of a new technology to actual commercialization, that can take over 10 years, if not greater, to get full economies of scale. And we know that making batteries is really difficult. We've seen in the news about some of the challenges with traditional lithium-ion batteries, how hard it is to make those. And if you're coming in with new technologies, new ideas, then you're just compounding the difficulty in that. Naturally, a lot of these early stage startup companies, they are so far down the TRL level that they are quite distant from that. As you go up the TRL levels in terms of larger and larger cells, there is loads of risk there in terms of it fundamentally not working. So to give you an example, there might be some exciting material that someone has developed. They might be testing it in a coin cell configuration, which is a common cell form factor, which is very small. But to actually scale that into a practical battery is quite difficult to actually realize some of those energy density claims that they might be having, because there are all sorts of challenges around how you design the cell and so on. So whenever I get involved with technical due diligence, of course, the fundamentals coin cell performance is important, and we do look at that. But until someone has demonstrated at scale with maybe a third-party validation, there's always going to be some uncertainty around how they're presenting the information, because people do play games in terms of testing under certain conditions, adjusting the parameters to give them slightly better conditions. So to give you one example, batteries are often a trade-off between energy density, power density, lifetime, and so on. In the coin cell configuration, we often put in a lot of electrolyte into the coin cell, which affects the lifetime of the battery. If you had the same amount of electrolyte in a practical cell, it wouldn't give you the same energy density. So we often play these kind of trade-offs. You can change the loading of the battery as well to give you better power characteristics at the cost of energy density. So it's these sorts of things that we need to overcome. And I would say the perfect battery, which has practical application, needs to solve the and problem, that I'm not just making a cheap battery and I'm not just making an energy dense battery. We're often looking for batteries which have energy density with power density with cost as well. And it's very easy for companies and researchers, don't get me wrong, to kind of play the game to show idealistic properties.
You just mentioned there are several approaches, ways to present the correct scientific results within scientific papers. Actually, that is very new to me, at least. You just recommended to us a very interesting paper by Patrick Johansson, Professor Patrick Johansson from Sweden. It is named 10 Ways to Fool the Masses When Presenting Battery Research. Very interesting, a very humorous paper, actually. I didn't know there is papers out there in this style even. Why did you recommend this to us?
I thought the frame of the paper was quite humorous, but behind that level of humor, I think it covers some very important topics there. That within the academic realm, I do think because people often sometimes chase publications in more glamorous publication forums, that they sometimes oversell the results. So one thing that you can do is whenever you give percentage values, you often need a baseline to compare against, and you need to make sure your baseline is representative. Also bearing in mind that some of these numbers do change with time as well. So comparing against old energy density numbers is not particularly fair. This is sometimes something we see in the startup space, where people forecast a decrease in the price of the cell and they compare it against lithium ion. The reality is lithium ion is decreasing at the same time. So you shouldn't be comparing against where you are right now. You need to be comparing against where it will be in the future. So it's doubly the challenge. But it also highlights this notion that you can play this game, as we've alluded to before, of kind of testing under one condition, showing favorable data for that, and then changing how you've tested the cell or changed how you've made the cell to show a slightly different result. And for someone who isn't kind of living and breathing batteries day in and day out, it's quite easy to kind of miss these things. But it's such an important thing to kind of ask the questions around, because it can quite easily fool someone into thinking that this battery has all of these things, but in reality, it's just how we presented the data or how we've conducted the experiments themselves.
Let me read out these 10 humorous recommendations for battery scientists. Always compare your results against the state of the art from 2010. Use only chemical reactions for the energy density, quote, cost only in terms of the raw materials used, carefully choose your cycling conditions, quietly change the procedure, layout, or materials composition, play the game of loadings and ratios, never do proper characterization of your promising materials. Anything can be solid state, right? Number 9 is errors, not here. Number 10, if all else fails, show pretty pictures and videos.
This is hilarious, but it also reads like an instruction for fraud, right?
Obviously, that article was done in jest, but obviously there are some elements of truth there. I wouldn't say everyone in the battery field are liars. I think there are some mistruths that are sometimes told, but this article certainly allows us the opportunity as a community to kind of ensure that we're honest about our results and transparent.
You mentioned that for this whole development, we should think in 10 years instead of maybe 1 year or maybe a quarter of a year. But now we have an economy that usually wants a quarterly result and benefit really, really fast. Do you think this is also somehow a structural problem that then translates also into the way research is presented? Because, yeah, since you just pointed out, the startup needs to acquire money. It needs to acquire it regularly and fast. And they want results fast and 10 years is not fast.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is one of the mismatches, and there are many exciting battery startups there, and I wish them all well. But the reality is very few of them have actually realized and gone through that kind of valley of death to actually make a commercial product. Obviously, there are companies which do that, and there are technologies which come through, but it's really, really difficult to do that. We know already that it takes a long time to commercialize battery technologies because not only do you need the performance, you need the lifetime, and you need to resolve all of these manufacturing challenges, which both requires large capital to get the equipment, expertise to execute it. And the reality is, in that 10 years that it takes to develop the technology, you could easily go broke. In that time, things could change in terms of the financial landscape and so on. I think when you look back historically, when we had a period of very low interest rates, money was a lot more abundant. And at that stage, you know, a lot of more things got funded. Arguably, some things which got funded probably shouldn't have got funded. And now we're going through a leaner phase where it's much more difficult to raise funding. And we're starting to see other challenges in that. I think we ultimately need to adapt to the landscape there. When we are trying to commercialize the technology, one of the main drawbacks or the things that holds us back is the lifetime of the battery. Because if you're claiming a battery which lasts 10 or 20 years, then you can see the challenge there in terms of lead time, that you're not likely to have that data. Of course, we can extrapolate and use techniques to accelerate it, but that's one of the challenges. But we also need to kind of think around the financial structures and managing expectations between the people financing these things, who inevitably want to pay back on their investment, and the people doing the science in terms of how long it actually takes and whether you can accelerate that. So I think it's an interesting time. There are still things to improve. I don't think funding battery ventures, we've mastered that so far, because there have been very many high profile failures out there, but we should learn from them.
Which are the learnings that you see that we can already apply now?
So to give you a few examples, I think gigafactories are fantastic, and they're really important because without the batteries, you don't have anything to put into your vehicles. But gigafactories also cost gigapounds in terms of the cost of building them. So they're hugely capital intensive. The margins, depending on where you are, can be quite challenging to make money. I think the Chinese battery producers are profitable, but other battery factories aren't, and you can't ultimately run a business unless you're actually making money. I think some of the learnings from some of the early stage battery gigafactories was to make sure that you match your ambition of having an exciting future without not stretching yourself too thin. That it's easy to kind of say, we're going to offer lithium metal, we're going to offer all these exciting technologies, but each one requires a significant amount of investment. And we need to focus on producing a good product which we can make at scale profitably. We also need to make sure that we've got the customers lined up, because without those customers, making those cells is a bit of a dead end as well. So it requires the integration of the technology, but also the business case. And I think taking a step back from automotive, which often people focus a lot on, I think grid is very interesting right now in terms of battery energy storage. And some of the interesting insights that I've found speaking to people in the field is that right now, grid energy storage batteries are huge in terms of capacity and market size. You're commonly seeing 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt hour systems. And actually, those systems are in the hundreds of millions of pounds to finance. The reality is that no one really buys those batteries with cash. You raise credit on them. And when financial institutions come in, they will assess the level of risk there. They will set a certain cost of the capital that you're trying to access. And right now, lithium iron phosphate and NMC batteries, they are the incumbent technology there, which people know. There's been trials. We know that. Can sodium ion go onto grid? Certainly it can from a technical feasibility. But right now, it's more costly from a fundamental dollars per kilowatt hour perspective for the technology. And in addition, if you were to install these large scale sodium ion batteries, there's huge risk. Financial institutions do not like risk. And essentially, I can tell you that the cost of capital there would likely be more expensive. So we're starting to see this kind of reinforcement where it's very difficult for new technologies to come through. I think that's where we can subsidize certain things like trials, which kind of build out that confidence there. So to reduce the risks. So that's where governments do have a role to play and research councils to say, okay, this has potential, but we do need to invest and not only demonstrate and see some of the practical challenges, but give confidence to financial markets and others that you can finance these technologies. If you got a mortgage on your house, the difference of 1% makes a huge difference in terms of how much you're paying.
I want to come back to these two standards you've been talking about, how degradation is presented in battery papers. For example, I have read that, battery cell chemistries that just came out perform, let's say, 1,000 or 1,500 cycles, for example, compared to lithium-ion batteries. Then I know charging speeds are sometimes presented in a very oddly way. For example, charging the cell from 20% to 80% in an amount of time. Very weird to read. But Billy, let's jump back. First of all, you just said there is a lot of promising startups within the battery field, at least in Britain or Europe. Could you name them?
One of the startup companies that span out from Imperial College actually is called Breathe Battery Technologies, which is using a software-defined approach so that we can monitor the batteries, we know how much current we can put in without degrading them. Now, you can achieve fast charging in a number of different ways. You can change the materials that we use there to achieve it. You can change the design of the battery. So you've probably heard of Tesla having their tabless battery design. It's actually not fair to call it tabless. It actually has infinite tabs or many tabs there. Or you can do a software controlled or a model-based approach to kind of do that. And that's what Breathe do. If you want to achieve fast charging, you can do it in a number of ways. If you reduce the mass loading of your battery, you can get better battery fast charging characteristics. So when you look at vehicles like the Porsche Taycan, which claim to be one of the fastest charging electric vehicles out there, and it is true, it can fast charge very quickly. And the challenge is that one way to achieve that is that you have thinner electrodes where you don't have as much resistance to the lithium ions kind of moving back and forth. That's great for fast charging. But when you look at the energy density or the range of the vehicle, there's a drawback there. It kind of goes back to, are we solving the AND problem or are we solving one problem in isolation? I think, of course, there is value in doing that, but we shouldn't ignore the drawbacks in that way in terms of the energy density drawbacks. So I would always ask these companies, you say all these great things, but what's the drawback? And if they say there isn't a drawback, then I'd get a little bit suspicious unless there is a strong rationale for why they have fundamentally solved that. I think lifetime as well, as you alluded to, these companies now are claiming very long lifetimes. And I think it's very difficult to get that level of lifetime, and it's very dependent on how you test it. So cycles is one way. But the reality is, you know, we can define cycles very differently. If I cycle my battery at very high C rates or high charging rates, I can actually do hundreds of cycles in one day, depending on how I define it. So I think we've got to use fair metrics where calendar aging is also important. So if you claim 30 years of calendar aging, well, it's going to take 30 years to actually prove that to a certain degree. So those are the sorts of questions which I often raise, which are often a bit murky in terms of what some of these startup companies kind of provide.
You just mentioned standards. Are there any standards? Because we just had a talk with Simon Clark, and he said, don't get into how to calculate cycles with a chemist. Yeah, you mentioned you can do it fast, you can do it slow, you can do multiple a day. You can probably also change from 20 to 80% or full cycles. What's a full cycle? So long question short, are there any standards that apply for everyone or standards that you apply when assessing a promising new technology?
I do think standards are useful, and there are some out there. So within the academic field, we often have standards or recommended best practices for testing batteries. I acknowledge that we have some batteries which are more power orientated and some which are energy orientated. I suppose the spirit of what we want to encourage is transparency, that to allow us to fairly assess those trade-offs, you should be reporting things like the mass loading of your cell and other conditions around the true C rate, how large is your cell as well, which is important, and those other factors which influence it. And then you can make an educated conclusion about those results. I'm happy for people to kind of test in a slightly different way, as long as there's a fair rationale for it and they're not doing it to completely mislead you in that sense. So I'm a bit pragmatic about standards. I think obviously for things like, as you're trying to commercialize technologies at a higher TRL level, for battery safety, there are certainly standards around how you do nail penetration, how you do short circuit. And of course, we should follow those. But as a technology is being developed, being aware of them, if you can do them, great. But equally, if there is a strong justification for deviating from that, being transparent with how you've done the test and why is equally as important. And that's where test houses kind of come in as a third-party validation as well, to kind of provide us with that confidence in that they've done the testing appropriately.
Let's pretend we're investors getting battery data presented by a, let's say, a very promising battery startup. I guess it's both, right? Sometimes the poor data is presented by the startup, probably not even on purpose. But on the other hand, we also see a bit of an inability of the investor to check the lab cells results of a specific tech, right? Sometimes they're not educated in a specific field of electrochemistry, right?
Often there is a startup company working with a fund, and they have a very nice PowerPoint slide around all the fantastic things with all sorts of percentage values around how much better they are, and then some indicative testing data. I think there is maybe a misalignment that investors sometimes think that the data can magically appear, and sometimes you can conduct additional tests. Sometimes it can be quite challenging that if you want additional data at low temperatures, high temperatures, or whatnot, naturally it will take a long time. And you've got to acknowledge that that data might not necessarily exist. And that's okay. It's just about understanding the risk about what data is there and what isn't there as well. So that's kind of where we are. But certainly the data which has been presented to investors initially is often quite high level. As a technical consultant, I kind of come in, ask some more detailed questions, and often there is data there, and then interrogating that, but synthesizing that into what does Coulombic efficiency mean for the investor? What does this definition of cycles mean for the true application? And that's what I try and synthesize for the investors. I want to see the startup succeed, but I need to be honest and transparent with the investor as well.
Lately, we get the feeling that the Chinese battery innovation strategies, they work a little bit better compared to our Western, rather short-term shareholder value approaches. So investors want to see like returns quite early. Is that right?
often we have these kind of stages of pre-seed, seed, series A, B, and so on. And depending on the investors you have, there might be some which specialize in certain stages. And naturally, they will have an exit strategy in terms of they invest at a certain stage. And then if it progresses and does well, then essentially they get a payout from their initial investment and risk taking there. But it does kind of encourage this kind of shorter term aspiration where you might have a runway of a couple of years. So let's say 2 or 3 years or even less. And in that time, you're trying to prove your technology. You're trying to reach certain milestones. And as you approach that next stage gate, if you haven't achieved that, because naturally battery science is a bit risky, then the pressure starts to kind of accumulate in terms of raising that next round and so on. So ultimately, batteries is a long game. It does require a long-term investment. And I think that's what the Chinese have done quite well with their industries there, that they're willing to kind of take those longer-term bets, provide subsidies and help. So things like land for equipment, favorable terms there. And, you know, places like the UK, EU, they're starting to explore these. But I do think having that view of this is strategically important, we're going to provide this level of support to this industry because it's so important, is quite key. And we've started to see the results of that. We're starting now to start to see a slightly different dynamic where the strong get stronger. And it's very difficult for the newcomers to come in. To give you an example, I think to my earlier point that battery prices is a moving target, I think lithium iron phosphate a few years ago, people almost wrote off. And now we're seeing the resurgence of lithium iron phosphate and the cost drop, ignoring all the tariff craziness, is really impressive in terms of lithium iron phosphate. I think the narrative for certain technologies like sodium was intrinsically very interesting, and sodium is still quite an interesting technology. But when you run the numbers, currently a sodium ion battery really can't compete against a lithium ion phosphate battery. Maybe in the long term it can do, but it does require significant investment in there to make sure that, you know, you do get that long-term success. Sodium has other benefits beyond just cost. So I don't want to just say that cost is the only driver, but we do need this kind of long view and acknowledgement that some things won't work as well.
Absolutely. In Germany, we see quite a lot of these huge gigawatt-sized batteries being planned right now. I think 2.2 gigawatt hours are installed right now, but we have something like 300 gigawatt of power being planned of these gigawatt-sized huge batteries. What are the main questions from the investor side before even starting to invest in these huge batteries?
So again, I think combining the technical with the economic, you start to see and ask different questions. So just like battery prices are evolving over time in terms of lithium iron phosphate is going down, it's starting to approach the level where it's a commodity and we're starting to see fluctuations in that. I think we have to think about the other side of that equation for battery energy storage. So you install a battery and connect it to the grid, and then you can generate revenue in a number of ways. You can balance power, you can do energy arbitrage. And right now, in some regions, it's highly profitable. As we deploy more and more of these systems, we've seen that shift quite significantly in terms of the profitability of those systems. And because it does take time to kind of put these systems into the ground, we need to look at profitability, not just what it is right now, but how might that evolve into the future? So that involves predicting energy prices. What if everyone has a battery now? Then suddenly your valuable asset is no longer as valuable there. So those are some of the uncertainties which I think people need to look at. I think there are interesting business models out there where people offer slightly different financial models or business models which mitigate some of the risks there. So there are some companies which specialize in basically paying a energy storage company for use of their battery. So they don't foot the cost of that. They agree to a flat rate in terms of paying the producer there. And their gamble is that they've got algorithms which basically arbitrage better than everyone else, and they basically work on that margin there. So the risk is shifted to different places, and I think that's quite interesting in terms of what you can do in terms of the integration of technology and the business model.
Talking about risk shifting, what role do you see for insurances here?
A battery is ultimately like many of the assets we own, like a car or a house, that whilst things go well, they can also not go very well. And you also need to think about what happens when things go badly right now. So insurance products are often used for your car insurance, your house insurance, and so on. And I think because batteries are a relatively new product in the grand scheme of things, we do need these financial services as well. You have insurance in terms of if something goes terribly wrong, like a thermal runaway event, what happens there? You also have types of insurance which are around the performance of your asset. So does it degrade faster than it's claimed? So some companies now claim 20 plus years worth of lifetime. And the reality is they're unlikely to have actually conducted those experiments because of the lead time it takes there. So some companies which have very strong balance sheets, they can actually underwrite the risk of getting it slightly wrong because they're already making money in that sense. There's some interesting companies. So I think there's one company called Munich Re, which basically offers extended warranties. So there might be a battery producer who claims a battery lifetime of X. And then depending on how the battery is being used, you can get insurance in terms of extending that warranty and so on. And I think that's really interesting in terms of it's opening up new business opportunities for the technology based on the shortcomings of the warranties that cell manufacturers might offer in first life.
What do you think? How long does a huge battery, a battery park, needs to pay for itself in terms of years?
Even though we can have singular batteries for $50 per kilowatt hour, we're looking maybe definitely over 100, probably closer to $200 per kilowatt hour for a system. And depending on how you use the asset in terms of where it's connected and the revenue streams, you're maybe looking at about 5 years. I'm kind of finger in the air estimating in terms of payback. Now, that can change in the future if the profitability of that shifts. So it could be longer. And you need to make sure that your battery asset, you don't need to replace the cells in that time. So there is uncertainty. I think it is profitable right now, and people are trying to get in whilst it is. But as we go to the future, my suspicion is that the profitability will be more challenging. So in the UK, it still is profitable for batteries. But compare that to some regions. So in Texas, I think it's highly profitable right now. But we're starting to see a shift away from that profitability. So people need to be careful of that. Alongside the fact that battery prices are coming down. So if you're looking at residual value of your asset, you know, you've bought your battery at, let's say, $100 per kilowatt hour, and instantly, because battery prices have gone down, the residual value of your asset has also depreciated. So there's some interesting dynamics going on there, which makes it even more challenging for new technologies to come through. But as an optimist, I do think that new technologies will come through, but we do need to kind of facilitate that process and help that growth.
Billy, thank you for all this insight. Now we have a rough idea of how the battery startup field is working and what players are there. Do you have any advice for future battery startups when it comes to developing a realistic business case?
Yeah, I think we do need these startup companies because we need fresh ideas out there. I would encourage all startups, even though there is the temptation to put these kind of headline numbers out there in terms of how fantastic technology is, to also be a bit pragmatic, be honest with your data, because honesty gets you a long way, especially for people in the technical due diligence area. It builds confidence that not only is the technology good, but the team can be trustworthy as well. I fully acknowledge that there are risks with developing new technologies. You know, we often say high risk, high reward. Companies often do pivot from time to time, and that's fine, but it's the team that kind of drives it forward. So making sure that your trustworthy partner is equally as important as kind of stating all these fantastic numbers out there.
Thank you so much for your time and expertise. To your audience, that was Dr. Billy Wu from the Dyson School of Design Engineering at the Imperial College in London. Please go ahead and comment in the comment section. What do you think about funding battery ventures? What is your experiences with all the battery data that sometimes are a little bit stretched, don't you think? Thank you very much. See you next time. Bye-bye.